It is a fresh week, but the same show. The Damage Report with me, Johnny Derola, and my Monday co-host, Brooke, is here.
Yeah, I'm here. It's always a new, fresh show with you every day.
Yeah, it's a new, fresh hell. That's what it is.
The life we live in.
And we've got that for you. Look, we got a lot of news. We're going to be starting off with some pretty dark stuff. It was a dark weekend because there was a series of terror attacks that claimed the lives of hundreds of people in Sri Lanka. We'll be talking about that and some really awful people sort of using it for their own political ends here in the US. We've got two awesome guests who are going to be joining us. So Jonathan Larson of 2IT Investigates. He has a big news story on Pete Buttigieg. Was that right?
I think.
By the way, I have a resolution for this week. Yeah. This is the week that I start pronouncing his name correctly.
I thought you've been doing it right.
No, nobody likes it. I pronounce it the way he said to, but it's not good enough for all the people who are not him. And I'm not saying I'm going to nail it today, but by Friday.
What do people who are not him want it to be?
I think Buttigieg.
Buttigieg. And what does he say?
He wrote it Buttigieg.
Buttigieg. Buttigieg. Buttigieg.
We write out things like as a guide to pronunciation as if that helps at all.
Right.
Because it never does. But anyway, that is my vow to you. So we have a big story on him. We have another little a bit of conflict potentially between him and Bernie Sanders. I'm not necessarily going to come down on the side that you might expect.
Oh, I am.
Oh. Okay. Well, one of us is going to be surprised. I don't know who. And look, Elizabeth Warren, another great plan. We're going to break it all down. We're going to be talking about Good Samaritans helping out migrants crossing the border. And then we're going to do a little flashback to about a week ago, AOC talking about Facebook. I want to talk about it with you.
Okay.
We're going to be talking about social media too. But we're going to be starting off with some pretty dark stuff. A series of bombings in Sri Lanka really just tore apart what was supposed to be Easter weekend, you know, focusing on your faith, people coming together, a horrendous series of attacks that have claimed the lives of hundreds of people. Nearly 300 people were killed. The last death toll that I saw was 290. I'm sure that that's being updated pretty much constantly. Around 500 others were injured in 8 coordinated attacks on churches and hotels in Sri Lanka in a number of different locations. The government believes that they've identified the terror organization behind it, but no one, including that group, has actually come out and said that it was them. And so it's possible that they know more than they've really described, but it's also possible that it's still speculation this early on. Although the Sri Lankan police have said that they've arrested 24 people in connection with these attacks already, and it, you know, obviously has not been long yet. So we were talking before the show. This is an analysis and commentary and context sort of show. Most of the shows on our network are. And so when we talk about something like this, we're not doing it because we think that we have something to add in terms of our opinion, or that indeed we think that our opinion matters in this case. But on this show, we take seriously the threats that we face as a country and as a world.
Right.
And this is an absolutely horrendous thing. And we just feel like we have to acknowledge that this is absolutely horrendous, not only for the people there, for Christians around the world and all of that.
I think, yeah, I mean, this is still a news show. And you were right when we talked about this morning. Sometimes you just have to report the news. There's nothing, what is there to say about this horrible tragedy?
Yeah.
This horrible thing that, you know, this newly identified group has done to all these families, all of these people, to this entire area.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I mean, covering the news, we've run up against there are a lot of attacks. Not necessarily on this scale, but there's a lot of mass shootings, and we want to cover all of them. But at a certain point, like you really become a little bit deadened to the constant horror that the news exposes you to. And you know, we want to make sure that for our viewers that we're being responsible in terms of seriously facing these things. But also, the last thing that we want is to drive you away from engagement in the news of the day, the news of the world, and what's really going on. And so I hope that we don't do that, even as we do cover things that can be incredibly dark. I want to read a statement from, I believe it's the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka, Ranil Wickremesinghe, who said, "I strongly condemn the cowardly attacks on our people today. I call upon all Sri Lankans during this tragic time to remain united and strong. Please avoid propagating unverified reports and speculation. The government is taking immediate steps to contain the situation." And I understand the concern expressed there about speculation, all that. We saw, I mean, how many different conspiracy theories were propagating in the immediate moments after we found out, you know, that Notre Dame was burning.
Right,
that's a constant worry.
It was an accidental fire, is what it still seems to be, right, at this point.
It seems like it, yes. I've seen videos of, here, I'm gonna blowtorch this old wood, and that's gonna demonstrate that this couldn't possibly have been an accidental fire, those sorts of things. Now, what's interesting, though, I don't know that it's tied, but apparently, according to the New York Times, Sri Lanka's security forces were warned at least 10 days before the bombings that the militant group was planning attacks against churches, but apparently took no action against it, indicating a catastrophic intelligence failure. Top government officials say the warning never reached them.
That is horrifying.
It is horrifying, but we also don't know to what extent it's true or specifically true or how credible the information was. You never know, you need more time. We don't have the expertise in this area to know. It will take some time to figure it out.
Absolutely, and unfortunately, there's nothing that can go back. You just don't want, though, if there was a warning, if there was some sort of warning. Unfortunately, things that seem just wild and bizarre and just ridiculous come to fruition far too often.
Yeah, and so for now, just our hearts go out to everyone who's affected by this horrible, horrible incident. And with that, we turn to something horrible as well. In the wake of the bombings in Sri Lanka, many people, understandably, took to social media to express solidarity and concern for those impacted by it, including people like Barack Obama, who tweeted, "The attacks on tourists and Easter worshippers in Sri Lanka are an attack on humanity. On a day devoted to love, redemption, and renewal, we pray for the victims and stand with the people of Sri Lanka." Hillary Clinton, too, "On this holy weekend for many faiths, we must stand united against hatred and violence. I'm praying for everyone affected by today's horrific attacks on Easter worshippers and travelers in Sri Lanka." And I think for regular people whose brains have not been infested by some sort of weird cosmic worms that are affecting some in ours, they see those messages and they think, oh, that's good. Thank you, you're being responsible and serious. But some didn't see it that way. Let's bring up the front page of Breitbart. "Obama, Clinton, Democrats denounce attacks on, quote, Easter worshipers, not Christians." And there were so many blue checked right wing Twitterers who were all very deeply concerned, hypothetically, about the attack. But they certainly seemed to be tweeting about the Easter worshipers that Obama and Hillary Clinton talked about there.
And it just feels like, how dare you? You know, the families of these people who've lost their lives, these people who are still in the hospital, these people who will never again feel comfort in their place of worship on a holy holiday. How dare you use that as some like political gotcha? Like, it just seems like the number one thing should be, where are your condolences? Not ripping apart this one right here. Just be worried about those families, those people who have suffered just in irreparable tragedy in so many different ways.
And this is disingenuous in like seven different ways. We don't have time to cover them all, so I'll just mention a few. First of all, this is the right wing saying, "How dare you call us Easter worshipers? We're Christians." Yes, we know they are consistent in caring about how people self-identify. That is why they never misgender people or anything like that. Also, I suppose Obama and Hillary were being politically incorrect in not choosing the term that you wanted. Political correctness, obviously the biggest problem facing our country. They say that all the time. Don't seem to care about the hypocrisy.
The actual terrorism happening here.
Exactly. But there's another way too. And so I want to credit Parker Malloy, who's been on the show, friend of the show, who noted some weird slip-ups in the desire to capitalize on this in the media. So you have the Washington Times, who tweeted, I believe it was today, "Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton tip anti-Christian Easter worshippers hats. They called the Sri Lanka victims Easter worshippers, not Christians. That's not just strange and unnatural, it's political calculation." Which is sort of weird coming from the Washington Times, since Parker Malloy noted that back in 2014 they tweeted, "Easter worshippers shocked as car rams church, injuring 21.
Oh.
That's weird. Why is the Washington Times tipping their anti-Christian Easter worshipper hats? And another site, you might be more familiar with this one, Daily Caller today put, "One word noticeably absent as Trump, Obama, Hillary, and 2020 Democrats respond to Sri Lankan attacks." Now, they had not previously used Easter worshippers, but they did know just a couple of years ago, "Tainted alcohol poisons dozens of Christmas worshippers." Hey, Daily Caller, they're not Christmas worshippers, they're Christians, get it right. And the ultimate, the worst, I think, first of all, there's the obvious hypocrisy. They cared so much about this, but not quite enough to actually search their own Twitter history. Also, the right, very concerned that Barack Obama and Hillary are not respecting true Christians. What did they do to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama? Hillary Clinton, for all we know, everything that she's said is a Christian. The right has all these conspiracy theories that she is a Satanist who drinks the blood of kids and all that, right, and that she's only pretending to be a Christian. Barack Obama, he's a Christian. They spent years saying he was a secret Muslim. How right. anti-Christian is that?
Right.
But very concerned now about a couple of tweets from a couple of politicians.
And it's important to say that there is no attack on Christianity. There has never been in modern times an attack mm-hmm. on Christianity here mm-hmm. in America. There is just, it's just not a thing. There is no attack on Christianity in America. And it's, and I say weird and gross all the time, and I'm just gonna keep with that. But it is gross that in the midst of actual terrorism, these people have found a way to center themselves as victims
yeah.
and pull in this disingenuous attack on Christianity. There is, how is that? I mean, come on. Like, they want to play oppression Olympics so bad
yeah.
that they would center themselves as victim amidst an actual terror attack where more than 200 people lost their lives.
Exactly. Yeah, we should be focusing not on that, not on trying to eke out whatever political advantage we can from the wording of a tweet. But also, I believe it was Parker Malloy who noted the right got a lot of traction on pretending that Ilhan Omar had said something that she didn't about 9/11. And it seems like, I mean, if that worked, the disingenuousness, we can really accelerate that. We can throw some gasoline on the fire there, because apparently it doesn't matter. Just pretend that an enemy of yours said something they didn't and attack them constantly.
Right.
And none of your supporters are gonna care if it's true or not. And we might be seeing more evidence of that. Okay, we are gonna take a break. When we come back, Jonathan Larson of TYT Investigates is gonna join us to break down his recent reporting on Pete Buttigieg after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today, and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
For the past few weeks, Pete Buttigieg has had, I would say, pretty good media. They've been very inviting of him.
Oh, pretty good.
They've been kind of in his corner.
He's been America's golden boy.
He's been America's golden boy. But did you know that there are actually things from his past that might harm him if people start to look into them? And we have a person who did look into them, and that is Jonathan Larson of TYT Investigates, who joins us on the show right now.
Hey, guys.
How's it going? Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So you have a story up at TYT.com right now about Buttigieg. Police tapes, concerns over racism in police department. Can you break down what that story was about?
So there's a lot of moving pieces to this mm-hmm. one. The existence of the tapes has been known for a while, since early on in Buttigieg's mayoral administration. What remains unclear is what's on the tapes. And in terms of what we did to advance that story is we got a hold of the settlement that Pete Buttigieg signed with the woman who got fired from the police department for her role in the tapes, laying out what the city's rationale was for wanting to keep quiet the contents on the tape, which specifically talks about the fact that if she shares what she knows from listening to the tapes, it could have a negative impact on some prosecution. So that was one thing we found out. And then another was that it turns out there was another incident involving police with racial overtones the following year. And according to the head of public safety, the board of public safety for the city of South Bend at the time, city attorney was fired by Mayor Buttigieg for failing to block a request to have the Indiana State Police investigate that incident. So those were the kind of big overarching themes, but there was a lot more I heard while I was in South Bend as well, as I'm sure you saw in the article.
Hey, Jonathan, so the police chief who recorded the other officers was fired. The woman who reported the tape's existence was fired. And the city employee who didn't stop, what you just mentioned, didn't stop a...
The Indiana State Police, the request to have them investigate, that's right.
Right.
The chief, I should point out, was not fired. He was demoted to captain. There's some controversy about whether he was asked to step down, whether he resigned and then rescinded it. That's in some dispute, but he remained on the force. He ultimately remained on the force. So there was one woman fired for the tapes and then another woman fired allegedly for failing to block a request for an outside investigation by the Indiana State Police.
Okay, so this is something that I feel like when this conversation was happening on Twitter, a lot of people want to know, is it really realistically possible that Pete Buttigieg has no idea what's actually on these tapes?
Well, I mean, he says he's never listened to them, but the reality is that the woman who did listen to them, or at least five of them, right? Because there's hours and hours of these tapes, mm-hmm. right? But it just, she made tapes of these particular days. I think it's 8 days or so that were all ended up on five cassette tapes. And she put her a summary essentially of what she heard on those tapes in her tort claim filed with the city that summer, June 2012. And she says there were racial remarks. She says there was possible misconduct. And she talks about a scheme to influence the incoming mayor into how he would fill new positions in the police department under his administration. So that's all out there. And she talked to the media. And so her secondhand account of what was on the tapes, he's had access to, certainly.
So do we know, I assume this is a little bit outside of the bounds of your investigation, but we have these things that we're certainly concerned about. There's an overall concern about racism in the police department. Do we know if outside of all of this, did he take actions that might allay some of those concerns?
So that was my thought. My interest was less in the tapes than in, well, is there a problem with racism within the force generally? Mm-hmm. And I spoke to multiple sources who had experience within and with the South Bend Police and the homicide unit that covers the county. And they gave me incidents that certainly sounded like racist language was used, if not other things. So I asked the Buttigieg administration and campaign, can you talk about what steps, if any, the administration took? And they sent a list last night that included, they sent a response that included some things such as body cameras and trying to recruit more minority officers. But in terms of institutional systemic change, it doesn't seem that there was any kind of major reform.
Okay, and so you mentioned the response from the campaign. Obviously, you also asked them questions about what we've been talking about throughout this interview. How were they receptive to your questions?
Well, you know, they were gracious and responded and all of that. So I can't. I'm just looking up the exact quote because I want to get it right. The spokesperson for the presidential campaign wrote that quote. So I sent him a list of questions dealing with a lot of things, including the involvement of one of his donors who ended up backing someone, a candidate who was allegedly caught on the tapes and who I was told by multiple sources use racist language. So I asked a whole slew of questions. And the response was, quote, these unsubstantiated allegations and rumors are too far-fetched to merit a response. And they went on a little bit to give more, a few more specifics about some of the structural things and some of the reforms I just told you about. But no, there were a lot of questions unanswered, such as a direct question. Did you fire the city attorney for failing to block the request for the investigation? No direct response. And in fact, we asked a couple weeks ago for the 2011 campaign disclosure records from his first mayoral campaign, and still haven't gotten those.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that's it. No one will ask any follow-up questions. He'll be on the debate stage. No one will ask about it. So this strategy should probably work.
But yes. We know what type of music he'd like to walk out to if he won.
Exactly. Jonathan, great work here. Hopefully, we'll get some more information, you know, as time goes on, and maybe they'll be a little bit more cooperative. But great work in finding out all this.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of stuff that we hit them with. So maybe additional answers are forthcoming. We'll see. Thanks so much, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. We're gonna take a short break. We come back a little bit more on Pete Buttigieg after this. Did Pete Buttigieg throw under the bus all Bernie Sanders supporters? As a Bernie Sanders supporter, I'm of course curious about this, and I saw headlines all over the place. So he was recently talking to a group of, I think it was high schoolers, and he compared people who support Bernie Sanders to people who support Donald Trump, and people have been very pissed, including some friends of the show, which we're gonna read in just a second. But first, the actual quote from Pete Buttigieg. I think the sense of anger and disaffection that comes from seeing that the numbers are fine, like unemployment's low, like all that, like you said, GDP is growing, and yet a lot of neighborhoods and families are living like this recovery never even happened. They're stuck. It just kind of turns you against the system in general, and then you're more likely to want to vote to blow up the system, which could lead you to somebody like Bernie, and it could lead you to somebody like Trump. That's how we got where we are. And so there, comparing people who might vote for one of the other candidates. Friend of the show, Ro Khanna, tweeted, come on, Pete Buttigieg, it is intellectually dishonest to compare Bernie to Trump. Bernie is for giving people healthcare, education, childcare, and more pay. He wants to blow up credentialed elitism, those who reject tuition-free college for all. And Nina Turner, also a friend of the show, responded, hello. So, is he throwing Bernie supporters under the bus?
I don't think this is about him. I think it's a bigger issue than him simply throwing Bernie Sanders supporters under the bus. He is minimizing the effects on racism in America. Mm-hmm. He is minimizing that this president's platform was racism and sexism and xenophobia, and all of his like financial policies really didn't make any sense. We've talked so much about his tax plan, mm-hmm. and how harmful that was to a lot of his supporters. We talk about his views on healthcare and how harmful that is. And we are always very clear that what brought a lot of these people together was racism. And so it's not about—
So you're saying he's inaccurately describing why people voted for Trump?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. And so it minimizes what the actual issue is. And a lot of people, they're afraid to say, they're afraid to say, hey, if you vote for a racist, you're probably racist, because they don't want to offend people who are totally okay with racism, totally okay with black and brown children being in cages at the border because they are black and brown. Totally okay with that, but swear to God that they have a black friend that they went to fourth grade with, and they cannot possibly be racist. They're afraid of those people. And
it only counts if it was sixth grade or later.
Right, exactly. And if there were two friends.
Yeah, remembers their friends from fourth grade?
Right, exactly. But I think it completely minimizes why a lot of people voted for Trump, or at very least why all of the people who voted for Trump were okay with some of the things that he said.
Okay, I think that you're 100% right. He is inaccurately describing why people voted for Donald Trump. I know that the popular wisdom is kind of what he's saying, that it was poor whites who were like, oh man, you know, I'm not a racist, but like it's totally cool to vote for racists. It's just that my factory shut down. I tried for like the first 18 months of Trump's presidency to continually cite all of the research showing that that's not actually why they voted for them. The areas where factories had shut down actually were not more likely to vote for Trump, that on average his voters had a higher income than Hillary Clinton supporters. I eventually gave up on that because people had locked into their heads that it had nothing to do with racism. But I think you're 100% right. That said, like not on whether he's
don't
right
put
about
butt
Trump.
On you were right. Don't.
No, I said that's it. That's different than butt.
Smooth. I want to live in that. For
you're 100%
a while.
Right. Let's luxuriate. But he is comparing them, and a lot of people are mad, including Ro Khanna, who is literally on. He's a campaign co-chair for Bernie Sanders. Nina Turner has some connection to Bernie Sanders. Tons, obviously. I don't agree though. And look, I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter. I don't normally talk like this, but like apparently in media, especially if you're in social media, you're supposed to be arrogant as hell. So I'm just gonna say, I'm a bigger Bernie Sanders supporter than most of the people who are angry about this right now. I don't think that he's throwing, look, he might throw Bernie Sanders supporters under the bus. He might keep saying things like this or go farther. And if he does, we gotta watch out for it. But what he said there, like Bernie says stuff like that.
And Bernie says that. Not perfect.
Exactly. I know, but I'm saying like that messaging is kind of what supporters of Bernie Sanders say that his crossover appeal will be that Bernie can get some of those people who maybe are Republicans or believe that the Republicans have their best interests because Bernie actually has their best economic interest. I feel like that's kind of a version of what we've been saying about Bernie the whole time.
Yeah, but you can't, he is the first, just the first sentence of Ro Khanna's tweet here. It is intellectually dishonest to compare Bernie Sanders to Donald Trump and the reasons why people vote support both of them. Well, that is an intellectually dishonest argument.
I agree on why people voted for Donald Trump. I think what he's saying is if there are, I'm just taking what is in Pete Buttigieg's statement.
Yeah, he's saying both sets of people want to dismantle the status quo. Mm-hmm. These people they want to dismantle the status quo because it's racist and it's awful. Mm-hmm. These people don't like that they see black and brown people sort of inching towards some form of equality that still is miles and miles away. Mm-hmm. And that is disgusting to them.
Do you think that it's the
thing that's not the status, that's not trying to dismantle the status quo.
Yeah. Well, and also
white supremacy is not like it's not, you know, I don't think.
And the worry then is if he is inaccurately diagnosing why these people supported Republicans, if he becomes the candidate, how is he going to campaign based on his false assumptions? It's kind of like the Tyrion thing. Like, how can I trust you, you know, if you've made all these mistakes? If he actually thinks that we can appeal to these people, that racism has nothing to do with it, it is purely economic, then he might tailor his message to people that might not really exist, or the number at least might be way smaller than he thinks it is.
Let me just say this, the person who cannot explicitly say, hey, this group of people, they're racist and xenophobic and they believe in white supremacy. The person who cannot explicitly say that sort of kind of matches the person who is in control of a city that has constant substantiated reports of racism within the police department and does nothing about it because he simply hasn't heard the tape.
Oh, so you're saying
they
that
match.
You see this as being part of sort
who
of a thread.
Is. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think, that's interesting. I mean,
those are just two sets of facts. So he didn't explicitly say what we seem to believe is true. And then all of these people who live in that town say, hey, he messed up here.
Yeah.
There was a problem and he didn't fix it.
Yes. And he hasn't really given us much of an idea of like his plans for the country. So we can't look at that and say that it might lead us to believe, if what we know of his history as a mayor and what he's saying right now leads us to believe one thing about the way that he thinks about race in America, we can't necessarily look to his policies to second guess that. All we have is that right now.
Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Awkward.
Okay. So perhaps he should be more concerned about the message he's sending to a significant portion of the country than just the Bernie thing.
Right.
Okay, I agree with you.
Thanks.
I also think that, so I guess see, we're focusing on the wrong thing.
I agree
you've
with you, you're
me.
Right, I also, but
no, I didn't,
we're
but.
Gonna get it together.
I said you're right, maybe kidding. We're focusing on the wrong thing.
What
I've learned from this is don't give her credit, it's not worth the trouble.
No, because then if it's not
worse
perfect,
than disagreeing
credit
with her.
Worse. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Okay,
but
you're
yeah.
right, and you're the worst.
Okay, I'll take that.
We are going to take another break, though. When we come back, we do have someone with another detailed policy. It's Elizabeth Warren. I don't know how she finds the time, but we're going to break down her plans for higher education after this. So for those of you who are watching live or listening to the podcast, we lost one of our guests. They're going to come back a little bit later on in the week. But that does mean that there is a increasing chance that we might talk about Game of Thrones before the end of the show. Because we plan a certain amount of content, the rest is Game of Thrones. That's just the way the world
That's
works.
That's just how life works, yeah.
Exactly. But before that, we are going to talk about some more policy though. Elizabeth Warren out with a new plan today on higher education, and it's something. She wants to eliminate up to $50,000 in student loan debt for every person with a household income of less than 100K. Borrowers who make between $100,000 and $250,000 a year would have a portion of their debt forgiven. No one making more than $250,000 a year would have their debt forgiven. This would amount to effectively canceling something like $650 billion in student loan debt. And obviously the way that it's targeted, and we'll get into more details, is designed to benefit people who are less well off financially.
Can we just put Nina Turner's tweet back up again?
Hello. And look, we're gonna talk a little bit about, there's been some reaction to it, some positive, some negative and everything. But this is a bold proposal. Mm-hmm. This goes beyond just, you know, 4 years of, you know, public college, like the Bernie Sanders plan. Bernie Sanders plan has other components as well. And she has that too. We'll get into those other details. But canceling student loan debt, that's a big thing. I mean, that's, I don't think we've ever had a major party candidate that proposed something like that. I believe that at one point Jill Stein had a plan similar to that. And so that's what I'm saying is that sort of policies has now been integrated into the progressive primary challengers in the Democratic primary this time around.
And I think, you know, it's important to note, not only is it a bold policy, but it's a policy. And as we were just mm-hmm. talking about, not every candidate so far has even given us any policies. And so this is a woman who has denounced racism, called the president on it, mm-hmm. called for his impeachment, been very explicit in things that, outside of the Native American debacle, which was horrifying, mm-hmm. she is really the only one of the only few. I think we've got some policies from Julian Castro, but mm-hmm. who just over and over and over again releasing new policies. Like, we know explicitly what type of presidency Elizabeth Warren is promising. Yeah. We're not trying to figure out who she is or what she believes in or how we would deal with this or this and that. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's laying it out, and that's what you want from a presidential candidate, right?
That's what I want. I mean, like, I guess I was thinking about this weekend and like since I saw this actually, and I thought it's like sort of just a gut thing, but I feel like if she was 37 and a guy, mm-hmm. she'd be running away with this thing right now.
Yeah.
Like if she could like hop up on a countertop like a cat and then talk about her policies, I think she'd be winning. But for some reason, even doing this doesn't benefit her for a variety of reasons, some of which we're very familiar with.
Would she even be pushed, you know, I wonder, to go to this level, because it would just be, the attention would be such a layup. All you have to do is, I don't know, be cute.
Yeah. But that's not to say that she would be accepted by all quarters. Obviously, the elites, the student loan, the people who manage the student loans, the bankers, they'd all obviously hate her for the same reason they hate like Bernie Sanders and all progressives. But I think that maybe the media would have switched over more. Anyway, I want to give you more details of the plan, though, because it's not just the student loan cancellation. In addition to eliminating the undergraduate tuition at public colleges and universities, which is obviously a big one, she would expand federal grants to help students with non-tuition expenses and create a $50 billion fund to support historically black colleges and universities. On top of that, her policy would also prohibit colleges from considering citizenship status and criminal history in admissions decisions, cut off federal money from for-profit colleges, and require an annual equity audit for public colleges that would identify shortfalls in enrollment and completion rates for lower-income students and students of color. So, I mean, you got you kind of have to do these two things at the same time. If you're going to cancel the debt, then you also would have to pay for the college to make sure that you don't just have the same problem in 15 years. But she goes beyond that, and I think it's a pretty awesome plan. Seems like it.
This is the best thing I think I've ever seen.
So we'll get to some potential negatives.
Okay.
But she said about it, it's reducing home ownership rates, the student loan crisis. It's leading fewer people to start businesses. It's forcing students to drop out of school before getting a degree. And I know what, you know, like Jake Tapper is gonna say, but how do you pay for it? Well, she thought of that. She would pay for it with revenue generated by her proposed increase in taxes for America's most wealthy families and corporations, with the campaign estimates to be $2.75 trillion over 10 years. And then we have a little bit of repetition there. So what I have seen from some, I think they're all on the right, but I do not believe that this will be constrained to the right for long, is one guy's article in Washington Times, he has a blue check, so he's a very serious writer, it's a slap in the face to the people who've already paid off their student loans. Maybe my cheeks are hardier than I thought, but I paid off my student loans and I don't feel slapped.
Right.
Like, I don't think that just because, look, so we were talking about this before the show. For years, I live in a very small place with very low rent. I drive a very cheap, very small car. I have effectively no social life and I don't travel. So for years, I put every dollar I could because I felt crushed by my student loan debt. I also went to a public college, and so my debt was lower than some people's is. And I paid it all off. And the idea that I would give the middle finger to helping out other people just because it wouldn't personally benefit me, how bizarre, how alien a way. Like Social Security is a slap in the face to the seniors who froze and starved to death before Social Security. I don't have cancer. I don't want the government trying to find a cure for cancer. We don't govern based on purely personal interest in how every dollar is advocated. That's not just unwise. That seems fundamentally evil to me.
Yeah, my friend Eric Haywood, I saw this right before the show. He tweeted in response to one of those ridiculous like criticisms. So anesthesia would be a slap in the face to injured soldiers who had to suffer surgeries awake on the battlefield. No, and it's also like a similar argument that you hear people who feel like they're logical have about increasing the minimum wage. Why should someone who works at McDonald's make the same amount of money as someone who's a paramedic? Well, maybe you should be focusing on an argument that a paramedic's job should pay more.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't be saying that someone who works 40 hours a week, regardless of what they're doing, should not be able to pay their rent, should not be able to get medicine, should not be able to buy food. Mm-hmm. That it's ridiculous. There's no comparison. The problem is that people work full time and aren't able to take care of themselves, just basic necessities, and that's not okay. So it's kind of like that same thing. I don't know, like, no matter how much it took, if you are able to pay off your student loans in a quick amount of time, there's some luck in that. There's some luck in finding a job, but there's some luck in that. Consider yourself lucky. Don't say that, you know, that's not fair. I just don't like it. Like the idea, like I suffered, so you should have to too. That is weird.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I would like to see it constrained to the Washington, I forget if it was the Times.
Examiner.
Examiner.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. No, that's not how we run the country. That's not certainly how we shouldn't run the country. It's antithetical to every value.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's not America. We help people out. Great plan there. Hopefully it'll get a good reception. We will see how seriously it's taken by the media. We'll also see if it's able to generate a couple of appearances for her maybe on the mainstream media. Bold plan, fixes a gigantic problem, takes the weight off of millions of people's shoulders. Maybe you can bring her on your show. We'll see. Anyway, we're gonna take a break. We come back more. On the internet, people who give advice about how you should live your life almost never are qualified to do so. It's like my personal contention that there has never been any relationship advice given on the internet where the person had any right whatsoever to do it. Like nobody checks these people's relationships to make sure that they're qualified, I don't think. But if we are gonna take life advice from somebody, AOC seems to have it all together, pretty much. So she's got some advice. This is from an interview last week with the Skullduggery podcast. And so she was talking about social media and how she has given up Facebook, and she explains, I personally gave up Facebook, which was kind of a big deal because I started my campaign on Facebook and Facebook was my primary digital organizing tool for a very long time. I gave up on it. I actually think that social media poses a public health risk to everybody. There are amplified impacts for young people, particularly children under the age of 3 with screen time. But I think it has a lot of effects on older people. I think it has effects on everybody, increased isolation, depression, anxiety, addiction, escapism, and she apparently started to impose little rules about her social media use, like curtailing her consumption of content on weekends. She still writes her own Twitter and Instagram posts. I've actually noticed that she doesn't tweet as much on the weekends now, and I think that's a great idea for her to keep together her sanity.
I think so too, and I think there was something like pointed out in one of these articles about this, how it takes longer than 2 days to fully feel the effects of a difference on your mind if you take social media out. But I don't think the average person gets the type of hate that she gets. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's healthy for any human to see that every day, even if you figure out a way to not internalize it. I just can imagine that like taking even an hour away from it would be good for you. Mm-hmm. So I imagine that she needs to take 2 days and just not look at it, because it's just attacks and attacks and attacks. And we always talk about how ridiculous it is that verified people get in on like these stupid arguments. Mm-hmm. Like, but she actually gets attacked by not only just verified people, but actual politicians, the president, senators, other, like, you know.
It is always weird when like, I think Neera Tanden, she was engaged in some online argument and someone responded, "Neera Tanden, you're arguing with a grad student at 1:30. It's just like, that's kind of weird, actually.
That's a good point.
Everything that you're saying about the hate that you get and the arguments you can get in is right. But I actually think that even if you don't get the hate, I think it's still, even the need to post, like being on there and absorbing a lot can be too much.
Yeah.
But on Twitter, if you feel like you need to be engaging in all these things, like if there's an event happens, I feel like I have to post about it, I don't think that that's positive either. I think that you should be, like, if you're engaging in these things, it should be because you actually want to, not out of a feeling of obligation for whatever reason. And so I will say, personally, I stay on Facebook only because I don't care about Facebook. It doesn't affect me in any way, so I don't feel like I need to avoid it. Some people's families, I guess, they fight more than mine do. I don't get a lot of hate on Facebook or anything in that regard. With Twitter, there's a very big part of me that wishes I could get off of it, because I do rage on Twitter sometimes, and I look at all of the people who just all of their activity is like replying angrily to people. A lot of the people who reply to me are like that. And I just think, how happy could you possibly be if this is how you choose to spend your time? But I can't, partially because I'm a little bit addicted, but also because of the job.
Like, yeah, you are really bad at unplugging. Like, I remember, I think it was the beginning of the year, you went on a vacation. We're like, okay, I'm gonna try not to tweet. And I think you lasted 2 hours.
Yeah. You send emails really early in the morning.
I do. Yeah. I do. It's I'm like addicted 5:30. To work.
I sent you an email. I was like, she'll get this when she wakes up. And there was a reply after like 2 minutes. I was like, why is anyone other than me awake at this time? It was like fast.
My Facebook is just beautiful. It's great. I'll never get off Facebook because I will delete you from my page at the slightest disagreement.
Oh yeah.
Because sure, I'm open to like different opinions, but I don't think racism and support of that and sexism is a difference of opinion. Mm. And so just at the slightest, like, I don't really like the way you're thinking, it's fine. I just delete you. Because Facebook for me is about like seeing people that I enjoy. Mm-hmm. And if I don't enjoy your rants, my Facebook page is not a democracy. You know what I mean? Like, so I follow, a lot of different like news organizations and things like that. It's a cheer-tatorship. It's really, it's Facebook. It's supposed to be fun. It's social media. It's fun. If I don't care about you or your kids, I'll unfollow you. And not that I don't, you know what I mean? It's just like, I don't care. Like, you know, I want to see only like my cousin's kids. Like, I don't know.
There's some
like
puppies.
A random friend from first grade. We don't need to be Facebook friends. I don't know you. You
I
know
have what some mean? Stuff like that.
That sounds
for
so
me,
bad.
Sometimes it's easier to keep people than to go through the stress of deleting them or whatever. By the way, you know when someone is broken through, as you were talking about your strategy, all I could hear was Marie Kondo. Like, your posts do not bring me joy. So I will cut you
clean
out.
Clean it up.
So I have cut out to the extent that I can. I haven't posted on Instagram in a while just because I'm bored, even though Instagram's like the most positive social media outlet in existence. But AOC, whatever you gotta do to keep it together, I'm all for it.
I just cleaned up people. Clean, clean, clean. It was really easy. The first election when Obama was elected, easy. I went down, lost 50% of my page. I'm from Oklahoma. Uh-huh. Then the second
one. Were some of them white?
Then the second page, the second election. Then it was like, okay, some people got, they snuck through. Okay. And then I think the last time was when the guy from Duck Dynasty was talking about his like homophobia. It was like really weird. And like there was like some anti-black sentiments in what he was saying. And I think one or two people were defending him. And I was like, oh, delete, delete. Now everything. Whenever something big or tragic happens, it's only positive.
Yeah.
Amazing. Smart people, and it feels good.
Yeah,
Facebook is a break for me.
Yeah, I have some family.
I still read YouTube comments, so like I still get your crazy
YouTube
opinions.
Comments.
I do. Yeah, I'm entertained.
Oh my
by
god,
I'm entertained by some of the insults too. It's funny to me. I read them out loud. Jeez. Sometimes they're funny.
YouTube comments are crazier than the writings of H.P. Lovecraft. Like it's just
what is that?
It's just it's a beast of 1,000 mouths eating itself in 1,000 ways. That's all it is. It's consuming itself. It's like it's a human centipede of one.
That
basically is
so
what's
funny.
Going on. It's eating and pooping simultaneously at all times. It's beautiful. Anyway. Yeah, maybe that'll be part of the clip. I guess we'll see. So we don't have enough time to make a clip out of Game of Thrones.
Right.
But we do have 2 minutes left. Second episode. I know it's weird that we end on this. I know that like Chuck Todd doesn't, but I don't care. It's our show. So
yeah,
do whatever
it's
we want. What do you think?
Okay, so remember I was disappointed after the first show, right? I wanted people to die. I wanted to see some action. I felt good after this second episode. I started to feel nervous that like I don't want anybody to get hurt. It started to feel really real again. And now I feel like Brett. Now I have anxiety for episode 3.
Yeah.
And so it felt really calming that there were a lot of really sweet moments. Like the little girl with
the grayscale.
Yes. And she was trying, oh my gosh, it was, and Gilly walking around helping and all that. It was too much.
Everybody was pitching in.
I know, I don't want anybody to die.
Yeah, it's like, the way I see it is like Winterfell right now is like the push for the Green New Deal. Like everybody finally gets it. They're all working together. Maybe not everybody can contribute in the same way, but you're all trying. And then like down in King's Landing, it's like, oh, there's some scientists who disagree. Cersei's like, well, I mean, I don't want to like push legislation that could cause me to like lose my office.
Brienne
Cersei
got
is
knighted.
Climate denial.
That was beautiful.
Brienne getting knighted was one of my favorite scenes ever.
There was also some like more explicit racism, which was entertaining. Not, I mean, yeah.
It was
all like allude to it, and now they're showing it.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. No,
right,
I would watch like Real Housewives of Winterfell. Honestly, I just love that stuff. Anyway, thank you so much. Yes. Thank you for watching. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.